welcome to the American Compass podcast. My name is Oren Cass. I'm executive director at American Compass. And this is the final episode of Issues 2024.
Wrapping it up.
Our special series discussing the issues people should be focused on in 2024 with no warranty or guarantee that anyone will, in fact, be talking about it during the campaign. But we can advise. Here to help me advise, my good friend, our policy director, Chris Griswold. How are you, sir?
I'm great. How are you?
I am doing well. I'm excited to talk about one of our favorite issues, family policy. I think there are too many ways to go with this one potentially, but we will try to stay disciplined and focused, much like all the best political candidates out there.
We have many of the best candidates.
We have all the best candidates, Chris. Why don't you get us started on why family matters?
Just a light, simple topic, like why family matters.
I just set you up for the Urkel joke, for our very specific older millennial.
Well, look, I mean, I think conservatives have always understood that the world is more than just the individual and the marketplace, that the essential building blocks of a healthy and thriving and free society are all of those institutions in between the individual and the kind of unfettered market. And family is first on that list. It's the fundamental building block of society. We know that. That is not controversial. I think if I brought what I just said to any conservative and said, "Do you agree with that?" They would say, "Yes, of course I do." And so would any, I think, just normal person out in the world. It's not even a partisan thing.
I like how there's the two types of people in the world, the conservatives and then other normal people. And then progressives also.
I think this is one of the ways in which the American public just simply is conservative and instinctively understands that family matters in a way that's special and that's distinct. And that is fundamental to a healthy and thriving society. And the reason why I think this matters so much in the context of economic policy is that economic constraints are one of the primary factors disrupting family formation, the ability of people to have and raise children. Half of Americans are saying they have fewer children than they want, and their top reason by a mile is that they don't think they can afford to have more kids. We've talked a lot about how the cost of achieving a middle-class, stable life is increasingly out of reach. And the costs of raising a family are rising much faster than the average wage. We see the fertility rate plummeting. So this is a very real crisis that is directly related to the economic problems that we have in this country. All of our polling and a whole bunch of other people's polling demonstrates the reality of how concerned people are about this. And that's why we need to talk about it. And the good news is that this is one of the issues that people are talking about right now. We just, with the time we're having this conversation, the House of Representatives just passed an expansion of the child tax credit. And we'll see what the Senate does. So it's a very live issue, and I think rightly so, because the public understands and is deeply concerned that something needs to change.
Yeah, it's interesting the way that you sort of described why everyone's so focused on this, which I think is exactly right. But it's important to say that this is very different than the way people were focused on the family issue not too long ago. And it feels like we've sort of transitioned from one phase to another without necessarily noticing it. And especially on the right, I think that's generated a lot of confusion. I mean, the original sort of focus on family breakdown, family values, the need for family policy emerged in the 60s, 70s, 80s at a time of, really dysfunction and family breakdown driven to a significant extent by the post-Great Society structure of the welfare state that quite unfortunately was designed to discourage people from forming stable families and in fact instead to give people support if they were single parents who were not working and withdraw the support if they got married or went to work. And the consequences of that, I think you could see very clearly in the explosion in, children born to unmarried mothers, in the decline of work in certain segments of the population, And part of what that generated as a response was the real focus on welfare reform, culminating in the 1996 welfare reform that I think was generally very positive. And you then see a real change in behavior after that. I mean, it's almost hard for those of our generation to remember the time when, like, teen pregnancy was the crisis, right? We don't have a teen pregnancy crisis anymore. What we have instead is this – it still falls under the heading of family, but it's a totally different issue. It's an issue that people aren't getting married – not that they're not getting married but then having children anyway. They're not getting married. They're not having kids. Even when they do get married, they're not having kids. They're not having as many kids as they want to have. And as you said, a lot of this comes down as self-reported to a very different set of economic pressures and ones that speak to a very different potential set of responses. And the polling speaks to that too. Not only does the polling tell us people care about this issue, that it isn't, you know, that they're having these problems, you see a totally different view than we might have expected historically, particularly on the right of center, in what that means for policy. I mean, we've surveyed a couple of times now asking parenting age Americans, we sort of focus on ages 18 to 50, asking them, should the federal government provide more support to families with children? What was interesting was even back in 2021, you had a plurality, about 49%, so, you know, call it half, said yes. Still at about 41% saying no. We just asked the question again a couple of months ago, and those numbers had shifted significantly. We were now at 64% of conservative and very conservative respondents saying federal government should provide more support, and down to 47%, or excuse me, down to 27%. Saying no, it should not. That is a sea change, 49 or 41 to 64, 27 in how conservatives are thinking about this issue. And yet I think we still see, except with a few folks in the political space who are really out in front and trying to lead on this issue, we see a lot of hesitance from conservative politicians to acknowledge this as an issue, recognize this as somewhere where government can be involved and where people want to see policy doing more.
No, there's a huge white space for policy leadership and policy entrepreneurship, as they say, in the space. Because you're right, I think there's a huge gap between what political leaders are offering and what the public wants. And it's fascinating to me in the polling data that it's not just conservative respondents, it's very conservative respondents, and that the respondents who self-identify the most strongly on the ideological spectrum, that doesn't diminish their enthusiasm for additional federal government support, which is, I think, breaks the brains of a lot of people in D.C. who are in the professional right-of-center world who really are stuck in this 1990s mentality that the only primary barrier to marriage and family formation and having children is some kind of welfare dependency. And even though that was true in the 90s, like, we did that. Like, we handled that. It's a very different set of concerns now, as you said. And I think you do thankfully see more discussion around the other economic trends that also matter. For example, the deindustrialization of America, which, among many other negative consequences, have left especially men, and especially men without a college degree, increasingly unable to access well-paying jobs. And all of the data is very clear that that makes men less marriageable, is the term, right? It makes it harder for them to find partners to marry and raise a family with. That's just the truth. That's just how it works. And if we don't figure out a way to, like, you know, provide a better answer to that, then we're going to continue to be in trouble. And that's a totally different discussion than, well, it's just about welfare dependency and that kind of 1990s era discussion. It's a different set of problems that need to be addressed. And I think that helps explain why not only, like, you know, moderate and somewhat conservative folks, but very, very conservative folks are enthusiastic about more help from the government.
Yeah, and you know, one dimension of this I think it's worth pulling in and thinking about a little bit is, you know, I'm actually looking at the data. I think actually the very conservatives actually are a little more supportive of the government involvement. And I think we have to talk about the Dobbs decision in this context also. You know, I think there was this sort of progressive talking point of, oh, well, you know, you're pro-life about abortion, and then other than that, you don't care. Never true. And now I think we're seeing it's not true, and that social conservatives in particular have really started to focus in on the question of what else does being pro-life and pro-family mean, and that you do also have to think about how to support families as they try to raise kids. And we've actually seen a lot of very socially conservative organizations, pro-life groups, be furthest out in front pushing the envelope on these kinds of issues. And so in a sense, it is, again, part and parcel of the broader realignment that we obviously talk about all the time, and this shift in what the conservative coalition is. Because the Reagan era, you know, so-called fusionist coalition, you really had the libertarians in charge of the economic policy. The social conservatives were told to stick to the social issues. And then you had your Cold War hawks. One of the consequences of seeing, you know, libertarians really sidelined, rightly so, on a lot of these economic issues, and more of a focus on, hey, what would an actually conservative economic policy look like, is social conservatives actually yeah. have economic views also, and those economic views are not, well, we should just let the market do whatever it wants to the family. And so I think part of what you're seeing in that pulling on the conservative, very conservative, is part and parts of this broader shift. And actually, conservative economic policy isn't the one that says, well, good luck out there. It's one that, as you said at the beginning, recognizes the indispensability of the family, recognizes that the market is not the family's friend, and that I think especially after we have let the market erode the foundations of the family so much for so many years, we now have an affirmative obligation to step in and do some reinforcing.
Absolutely. And, you know, we were a bit harsh on political leaders at the beginning of the conversation. And you said, you know, with a few exceptions, people are failing to offer. Well, I think it's useful to talk about the exceptions. You know, our friend Senator Marco Rubio and Senator Lee have proposed expansions of the child tax credit. Senator Hawley has proposed an entirely new approach to a parent tax credit. Senators Romney, Daines, who's the chair of the Senate Pro-Life Caucus, to your point, and Burr proposed the Family Security Act, which is an even more kind of innovative monthly family benefit issued out of the Social Security Administration, which garnered very strong support, not only from a bunch of conservative, you know, intellectuals and pundits, but from the pro-life and pro-family and religious communities. And I think the last person on this list who deserves a real shout out is Ways and Means Chairman Jason Smith, who just put and got passed out of the House an improvement and strengthening of the child tax credit. Does a number of things that I think are quite useful, and that proposal also got a lot of support from the pro-life community, which came out extremely strongly in favor. Including with the special enthusiasm for some of the provisions that most ticked off the libertarian, welfare-obsessed, dusty legacy institutions.
We should talk about that because, you know, we get into wonky policy details some other time, or you can listen to our previous podcast episode on that issue, talking policy shop when we were talking about also the American Compass proposal, the FISC, which I still think is the best of all of them, but, you know, goes in the same direction as these things. And so you can get into, you know, exactly how you want to design it. But I think at the core of a lot of this fight is the question of, when it comes right down to it, in the broadest political and philosophical sense, what is owed to whom? And for a long time in that kind of welfare reform context, the idea was, you know, we need to make sure we're not just sort of sending money to people, because especially in these welfare programs where you send money to the person who doesn't work and then take it away when they do work, that obviously creates horrible incentives. And I think conservatives rightly said that's not the right way to help people out of poverty.
It's the definition of a perverse incentive.
That's right. That's not the way to help people out of poverty. That's not the way to support strong families. Where we landed by default instead was to say, all right, what can we do in the tax code? Right, we're going to do this child tax credit. let's try to reduce the amount of taxes that families actually owe. That did a lot of good for a lot of people. But what I think folks have started realizing in recent years is, okay, but wait a minute, what about the working family that doesn't owe a lot of taxes? If you are a, you know, working class family, maybe you are a single parent, maybe you're near minimum wage, maybe you're not able to work full time consistently, but gosh, you're working hard and trying to do the right thing and support your family. Where do you fall in this universe? And the libertarian sort of welfare reform view was always, well, look, you know, earn some more money, pay some more taxes, and we can talk. And I think what you're now seeing a lot of these conservatives say is, no, wait a minute. That's that's exactly who needs the support and is actually absolutely deserving of support. And it's not welfare to go to that family and say, especially in these years when you are not only doing the work of trying to support yourself and a family, but also trying to do the work of raising the family, we should do what we can to help. And if that means more cash support is going to that family than they're paying in taxes, so what? That's not the question.
Well, and there's another actor in this drama, which is the nation itself. I think is really important to remember. There's a national interest here as well, and that it is entirely appropriate to say we have a national interest in making sure that families can form and raise children, and that it is appropriate for us to make policy accordingly. It's not just a question of compassion for the struggling families, although it is that as well. I think it's also important to recognize that as a matter of social stability and societal health, we need people to be doing this. We need families to be able to be formed.
And by the way, and we need them to be financially stable,
yes, exactly,
as we're trying to do it. I think,
yes,
one, we get into this a lot in our work on the FIST, the question of what is actually the rationale?
That is the Family Income Supplemental Credit.
That's correct. I one time was talking about it and couldn't even remember the acronym.
So which is the American Compass proposal, which all of you should go and look at immediately.
Thank you, Chris. Link in the show notes. But one of the things we really thought about hard as we were designing that is, what is the actual case for this, right? So some people hear parenting is hard work, we should pay parents. I think there's a lot wrong. And interestingly, in our survey, we sort of check these rationales. That is not what people are thinking when they say families deserve support. There's also rationale that has a lot of appeal to some folks with this idea that there's sort of a direct incentive here, that if you kind of offer people more money, they'll have more kids. And I think, frankly, the evidence for that isn't especially good. And beyond that, I think conceptually,
it's a little creepy.
It's a little creepy. If you told me it worked incredibly well, maybe I could get over the creepiness. But it's,
right,
when we talk about why we want to do family policy,
it's not a social engineering kind of.
That's right. And it's not like, well, let's find people who don't want to have kids and pay them to have the kids anyway. But what I think is incredibly important is to say, look, if you are that working family raising your kids, we also want you to be doing that in a stable way.
Yes.
To your point about,
yes,
that being important to social stability, obviously that being important to the well-being of the kids. And then also I think that being important as people who are deciding their own life course, if they want to have kids, look out there. What you want to have is a community full of families that are making it work, where ends do meet. And if public policy can help make that the case, that's going to be incredibly powerful to the health of those, not just the kids and the families, but to the communities. And in that sense, I do think ultimately in whether we have a culture that values and supports and encourages that behavior that we need.
No, exactly. Which is a very different mindset than analyzing all these questions through an obsession with the wrong people getting the wrong amounts because they're somehow undeserving. And this kind of welfare, this outdated welfare discussion that really has emerged in the last few weeks. As I said, we're recording this podcast right after the House passed this tax deal. And you've seen the reemergence of this discourse that is incredibly outdated and is just not suited to the realities of, number one, what the policy does, but number two, the point that you're making, which is this isn't about that's not the fight we need to have. The fight we need to have is, how do we make sure that families can make ends meet so that they and all the rest of us are better off. And I'd like to hear you talk actually a little bit about the word welfare and how that's been used and misused in the current discussion. Because I think it's really, really important to be clear about that and to call out the people who are, I think, misusing or the term or wielding it somewhat disingenuously for outdated policy goals.
Yeah, so I actually, our loyal listeners know we always wrap up with epic fail, talking about how not to talk about an issue. I think we should switch there a little sooner than usual because, to your point earlier, this is something people are talking about, and a lot of people are talking about it wrong. Frankly,
there's a lot of epic fails going on,
and it's also, if you can avoid the epic fails, it's not that hard to do it well, right? Like, and as you've been saying, this actually comes very naturally to conservatives, that this is important. It's obviously very popular to be supporting it, in a sense, if we can get out of our own way. So let's talk about you, sir.
Yes.
Well, thank you. You're very kind. This welfare point is fascinating. We've talked about sort of how that the mentality of welfare reform. You know, I think there are a lot of people who say like that was the signal victory of the conservative movement. Maybe up until Dobbs, for those who see the pro-life issue as a particularly core thrust, but. For an entire generation of conservatives, that was the proof that conservative ideas matter, conservative policy can work, and you could in fact see the results. But it has led to this situation where, you know, going on 30 years later now, my gosh, I mean, we should do something on this. We are almost as far from welfare reform is from the Great Society. we have had about as much time with no AFD, yeah. You know, with no messed up system as there was with the system. And so I think it's important to say, you know, look, there are two meanings of the word welfare. I mean, there is for, you know, people at public policy schools or, you know, economic historians.
The formal definition.
There's the formal description and what we mean when we talk about, quote, you know, the welfare state, where welfare literally means efforts by the government to help people. I mean, it's literally there, right, in the preamble of the Constitution, the general welfare. Let's be honest, just about any policy is welfare in that respect.
Yes, right. In the descriptive formal
public
sense,
education, right, yes. I don't know, maybe that's welfare. Social security and, you know, I guess that's welfare. Yeah. And so there is a way you could say, okay, well, let's, you know, technically it's all welfare. And in that respect, the kinds of support to working families we're talking about, I guess, would be welfare too. The problem is that's
not, like every other policy. Right, yeah, exactly.
The problem is that is, of course, not the politically salient meaning of welfare, and it's not the way people mean welfare when they are using the word to criticize the program.
Right, right.
When we use welfare in that sense, what we are talking about is this idea of sort of unconditional assistance provided to people, and especially means-tested assistance. So it is both unconditional if you are not working and taken away as you do work. And also, by the way, in a lot of cases, it goes to people without reference to, you know, whether or not they can work, right? So disability or mm-hmm. Social Security for the elderly is very different than the able-bodied young man who's not working.
Well, and there's a politically prohibitive valence to it, right? Where if you can label something with that version of the term, it's off the table. Because there's a moral question here too, which is that if you can work, you should be working, or at least be trying to work, which is a longstanding conservative principle, again, which the majority of the American people, I think, instinctively agree with. That's why no one has a problem with Social Security, because they understand there's a reciprocity there where you've worked and paid in, and then the program is there for you when you need it. Nobody has an issue with that. And so if you can tag something with that kind of morally dubious welfare, well, okay, this is for people who are able but unwilling to even try to work, then yeah, you know, that kills the discussion right out of the gate because, you know, for the reasons you're saying.
And so what's been so frustrating, I think, in this child tax credit debate as an example is you've seen – so what does the child tax credit proposal do? There are two sort of elements that really frustrate people. One is it has what's called this look back. Mm-hmm. So instead of only being eligible if you are working in the year you claim the credit, you would also be eligible even if you needed to look to work you did the previous year.
You can choose this year or the prior year's income as the qualifying measure.
And so there have been those who have said like, ah, well, that means maybe somebody will work 1 year, but they know they'll still get their child tax credit, so maybe they'll stop working the next year. I think the American Enterprise Institute had a paper. They had the single mother with two kids. She's earning $40,000 a year. She gets her child tax credit. Well, maybe she just won't work the next year. Now, look, if you know any parents out there supporting two kids on $40K a year who are just going to be like, well, maybe I'll just go with the $4,000 child tax credit next year, we would like to hear from you here at...
Yes, from the four of you there are in America who somehow think $4,000 is worth more than $40,000.
We would love to hear from... Now, you know, as I think everyone recognizes and as the welfare debate did underscore, incentives matter.
Of course.
But one has to both recognize that incentives matter and apply the lens of human rational human behavior. And so so you have that issue. Do we need to be concerned that somebody might use the fact that they worked last year as the basis for the credit? And then we have the issue that how much can they receive? And this is this point that we've been talking about. Should we just tell them they can have their own tax dollars back? Or could you have a low-income family that is working, that doesn't owe a lot of taxes, but gosh, they should get the full benefit too? Mm-hmm. And that's the place where I think you've seen folks like the Heritage Foundation, like Americans Advancing Freedom, come in hard saying this is a welfare expansion. I think, you know, Robert Rector, one of the heroes of the 1996 reform, I used Control F. Used the word welfare 38 times in his critique of this proposal, and it's just really important to say that that is not a good faith criticism, because you are using the word welfare to paint a picture in people's head that is not the nature of the policy you're describing, and that's the gap. If you want to criticize the idea that someone might receive more cash than they have paid in taxes, that's fine. A lot of libertarians have that position, and you can explain why you don't think we should do that. But to use the word welfare, you and everybody else knows what you're doing, which is trying to paint in people's head the picture of that thing that we didn't like before welfare reform that needed to be fixed. And that's not what anybody's talking about.
No, and it's especially frustrating the way I think some of these groups have shifted the goalposts, where at any given time, what we really mean by welfare is like, well, anything that's beyond returning parents' income tax liability back to them. Oh, no, anything beyond they're returning their payroll tax liability. No, what we mean is anything at all that doesn't require work and then penalizes you when you start to. No, we don't even mean that. Now, somehow, we're at the place where they are describing a proposal that incentivizes and requires and rewards work. As also somehow welfare, which really is just to say any policy that takes a step towards health.
Right.
It's like, well, come on, guys.
And you see this where they'll even now say, well, the earned income tax credit is welfare, right? We have the program that we have specifically to encourage and reward work for low-income workers, well, that's welfare.
Yeah.
And then you say, well, but wait a minute, that also was a conservative policy victory. The child tax credit itself was a conservative policy victory. And at some point, it seems like, again, to the point about just sort of getting out of our own way, you have this set of conservative principles that is uniquely well-equipped at this moment in time to speak to the key concerns of the nation, of working-class American families.
Yes.
You have the conservative policy solutions that are the right ones to address it.
And the public's goodwill. I mean, these are principles that resonate with and solutions, principles and solutions that resonate with the majority of the public. So it's sitting right there for whoever wants it.
Doing the things that need to be done would encourage the exact set of behaviors you want people to be doing more of. And then you have like, oh, but remember, you know, I analogize it to the star quarterback from high school who's like, oh, but you remember that game, guys? Like, you remember that awesome pass that Mac caught? It's like, yes, it was a great game. We loved it, but
we were there. Yeah,
we were there, but it was 30 years ago, and at some point, don't you think we should be actually trying to solve the problems of today?
Well, and to get back to a point you raised earlier, which I think is a really, really important one, is the disconnect between this like stuck in the 90s mindset that calls itself conservative and the actual social conservatives who are concerned about the problems of today. The look back provision that you mentioned, which would give families that little bit of extra flexibility if they have some kind of unexpected disruption in their income stream, is one of the specific policy provisions that the pro-life community especially likes, because what they see in that provision is, oh, wow, an expecting mom can work a little bit while she's carrying her child. And then when she gives birth, she's going to have a little bit of flexibility to stay home with that child.
And also she or the father, you will also then going forward have to have someone working.
And this is exactly the kind of family first thinking where, like, wait a minute, what is the interests of the child? What are the interests of the parents as parents? Let's care about that first. And as once you make that mindset shift, this is something like the look back provision. Not only is it acceptable, it's desirable. And you see that reflected in all these pro-life groups and religious groups that have come out strongly in favor of this tax deal that's now headed over to the Senate. So there really is a choice to be made, a time for choosing, if you will, for conservative leaders to like decide what they mean when they call themselves conservative.
Yes. Well, and I want to make one more point that, you know, something that I've been really heartened by on all of this is – you know, I think something that limited government conservatives always are concerned about, and for the most part are very right to be concerned about, is sort of like the slippery slope. Like, well, this is all taking us down the path to this other thing. And look, a lot of times that happens, and you certainly have to look around that corner and think in those terms politically. Here the concern is, oh, well, if we start doing this, if we start sending money to families beyond what they pay in taxes – well, pretty soon you are going to be sending money to families that aren't working at all. Pretty soon you are going to be doing universal basic income. And so that's why we have to hold this line in this sort of you can only have your tax money back. And I don't know, in the abstract, I guess I could be like, well, that's an interesting argument. But in this case, we actually tried it. The Biden administration in 2021 said – we're actually going to make this unconditional as part of one of the COVID relief packages for a year. In fact, every family got the money regardless of whether or not anybody worked, and it was not popular. We've done a lot of polling on this showing it was not popular. The Biden administration realized it wasn't popular. Go back and watch Joe Biden saying working families over and over and over and over again, because the idea that it would be sent to a family not connected to work was a non-starter. The Democrats tried to hold out to get it extended as a permanent package, and they lost it. That's what it expired and set up this fight now. And now the compromise that comes out is not back to that. It's actually this other thing that says exactly what should make sense to conservatives. We want to support working families, but they do have to be working families.
But we do want to support them.
But we do want to support right, them.
Exactly.
Those, in fact, are not contradictory ideas. They are
they fit quite nicely together, in fact.
They are where the American people are. And yes, we can now see that our political process is perfectly capable of drawing the line between generous support to working families and
– yes.
But that is not how we – you know, we still have a safety net for a family that's not able to work. But that is a very different situation.
Exactly.
And so that I feel like that is, again, right, that is the conservative answer. It is now where we are landing, and it's something conservatives should be out there pounding the table on. It should be a conservative victory that they held the line against the progressive unconditional payment and instead landed here. And conservatives can claim that victory and take it forward and do a lot more with it. Or they can totally squander it.
Well, so maybe in the spirit of just totally messing with our epic fail segment, if the epic fail belongs to these legacy groups that are I think misleading Congress and the public about what welfare means and what this current tax proposal means, let's assign them the epic fail. Let's assign Chairman Jason Smith and the House of Representatives an epic win for passing this overwhelmingly. And then let's have an epic TBD for the U.S. Senate, because this is headed to the U.S. Senate. And this, I think, will be – it is a live fire exercise for conservative leaders in that chamber to decide whether they want to take the opportunity you just described.
This is a great point. If you senators of the United States are on the fence, is this something you want to get behind and lead on? Know that Chris Griswold and I stand ready, to award you the epic success award. Yes. And know also that if you go wrong, you may be featured next time on the American Compass Podcast Epic Fail segment.
We'll see you then.
We'll be back. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you, Chris Griswold. This has been the American Compass Podcast on the American Compass Podcast Network.